Welcome back to our study of the book of James. In this session, we will begin looking at the final chapter in the book, James chapter 5. And if I could add three words to really summarize this chapter, he'll be talking about prosperity, patience, and prayer. And we see also a symmetry here in the book of James, because I see him addressing all three of those things in the beginning of his book, and now he returns to all three of these in chapter 5. Prosperity was addressed in chapter 1, verse 2, and it's here in chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. Persecution was also covered in those verses. In verses 3 and 4 of chapter 1, he talks to us about persevering and enduring. And we're going to see that in the middle part here of chapter 5. And then in chapter 1, verses 5 through 8, we have lessons on prayer. And James will conclude his book largely dealing with the subject of prayer. It's been said that the first few verses here in chapter 5 could be considered lifestyle of the rich and foolish. You might remember a TV show some time ago entitled Lifestyle of the Rich and Famous. Well, here James gives us lifestyle of the rich and foolish. He then talks to us about patiently waiting on the coming of the Lord. And then in verses 13 through 18, we see the great power in prayer that James is going to talk to us about. And in that section, he gives us three great reasons for prayer: our afflictions, our illnesses, and our sins are all great motivators for us to pray. And he's going to deal with the role of the elders in prayer and healing within the family of God. He's going to talk to us about confessing our faults one to another in verse 16. And finally, he'll talk to us and he'll conclude his book with the two verses, verses 19 and 20, about rescuing someone who has fallen into sin. So without further ado, let me begin by reading the first six verses of James chapter 5. Come now, you rich, weep and howl at your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you, and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasures in the last days. Indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, or cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord Sabaoth. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just, and he does not resist you. James in this section turns his attention to the wealthy landowners that we see in verse 4 who had laborers who worked in their fields. And he turns to them with a dramatic denunciation. He denounces them for their materialistic accumulation of wealth, for cheating their workers out of their fair and due wages, and for their self-indulgent actions that have led to the death of innocent, righteous people. This is a reoccurring theme seen many times in the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. James does not condemn them for being rich, but for the abuse of their riches and their positions. James echoes the cry of many of the prophets for social justice. Nowhere in the New Testament are the rich denounced simply because they are rich. Many godly people have been wealthy from the days of Job and Abraham until the present day. But the Bible strenuously insists on wealth's responsibility and warns of its temptations. Jesus in Luke 12:48 says, "To whom much has been given, much shall be required." The New Testament warnings about riches are a reference to wealth held without regard for serving God. Yet there is an inherent temptation in riches themselves. Wealth within itself brings an evil temptation to trust in self rather than God. And we find ourselves back to the theme of pride. To become a plutocrat or someone who uses wealth for power. These verses, James 5, 1 through 6, I believe have two primary aims. First, to show the ultimate worthlessness of all material riches. And second, to show the detestable character that often accompanies those who possess them. In verse 1, he says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you." That phrase, "come now," is the exact same phrase that he used in chapter 4, verse 13, when he said, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to such a city to spend a year there, to buy and sell and to make profit." It's a phrase designed to arrest the attention of the hearer or the reader. The verb for "howl" that we find in verse 1 is olazeo, and it carries the idea of to shriek. It's a dramatic exclamation, a lament, a loud cry, whether it's for joy or for grief. Here, I think it depicts the frantic terror of those upon whom the judgment of God has and will come. It's often debated as to what fearing God means, but I think we need to fear what God will do to us if we're disobedient enough so that we will conduct ourselves so that we won't have to fear it in the judgment day. Some have supposed that the miseries refer to the pain suffered at the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. But the poor would have suffered then as well as the rich. So I think it's more likely that we are dealing here with the judgment of God upon a self-hardened and rebellious people in the judgment day. Jesus in Luke chapter 6, verse 24 says, "Woe to you that are rich." It doesn't mean rich people cannot be saved, but it is a solemn warning to those who are rich against the tendency to delight and trust in those things more than they do God. Verses 2 and 3 now in chapter 5 read, "Your riches are corrupted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasures in the last day." All the major kinds of wealth of that day are enumerated here by James. The riches that would be corrupted are supplies like corn and oil, fine clothing, gold and silver. In these times, these were the main three sources of wealth, and James shows how each will fail. The grain will rot, the clothes will be eaten by moths, the metal will corrode or rust. Jesus did this same thing in the sixth chapter of Matthew. He said, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal." Solomon, writing in Proverbs 11:28, says, "He who trusts in his riches will fall, but the righteous will flourish like foliage." The idea of trusting in our riches here on earth that will be consumed or become useless with time. He says it will be a witness against you. This is very similar to the phrase we had about the blood of righteous Abel crying out unto God after he was killed by Cain. In Genesis chapter 4, verse 10, it says, "And the Lord said," speaking to Cain, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground." You know, God just doesn't miss anything, does he? He heard the blood of Abel crying for justice. He's going to hear the cries of the defrauded and abused here crying for justice. Just as ill-gotten and ill-used wealth of the rich ones would cry to heaven for vengeance, their ill-gotten and hoarded gains will stand against them as a witness in the judgment day. The justice of God will prove out in the end. And James says, "And these things will eat your flesh as fire." This ill-gotten, ill-used, hoarded riches will be their destruction. In their commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, "The rust which once ate your riches shall then gnaw your conscience, accompanied with punishment, which shall prey upon your bodies forever." And now to verse 4 of the fifth chapter. "And indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord Sabaoth. Just like the blood of Abel cried out, the cries of these people who have been cheated and defrauded is going to be heard by the Lord. And they are those that are rich are condemned for two sins, the improper use of their wealth and the sinful acquisition of the wealth through cheating and fraud. The word here for defraud is from the Greek word apisterio, and it means to keep back by fraud or to defraud. And that is exactly what was being done here. It's used in a similar way in Mark chapter 10, verse 19, where Jesus said unto him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. You know the commandments. Do not commit adultery. Do not murder. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Do not defraud. Honor your father and mother." And Jesus there is obviously referring to what we commonly call the Ten Commandments. Now, when we go back to Exodus chapter 20, there is not one of the commandments specifically that says do not defraud, but that is commonly looked at as a combination of do not steal and do not bear false witness. And that's the thought that James is combining here. The idea of to cheat and deprive, to leave people destitute, it really doesn't occur, this word, very many times in the New Testament, but here in James chapter 5, verse 4, it is used. And it refers to a failure to pay what we have agreed to pay another individual. They had prospered by cheating their laborers. To pay their laborers, which had been withheld by you. The poor needed their money every day in order to feed their families. But the rich withheld it to assure that they would return to work the next day. And we are told that the cries of these defrauded people will cry out unto the Lord, as has been referenced other times in Scripture, and has reached the ears of God. Sometimes God is referred to in what's called anthropomorphic ways. God has eyes, ears, hands, feet. Well, whether God actually has those in the way we're thinking, I do not know. But it's a way for the Bible to describe God in ways that we can understand. And here the Lord is referred to as the Lord of Sabaoth. It's an expression that means Lord of hosts, the God of the heavenly armies, the God of the heavenly hosts. It's a title that we find also used in Romans chapter 9, verse 29, where Paul there utilizes it. It pictures God as a warrior going into battle against his enemies. Now to verse 5. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in the day of slaughter. This idea of living luxuriously and led a life of pleasure is similar to Jesus' parable that we find in Luke chapter 16. We commonly refer to that as Lazarus and the rich man. And the rich man certainly did live a luxurious life of wanton pleasure. But we see that his reward was far, far from that that was received from the righteous Lazarus. The term connotates a self-centered, extravagant lifestyle. Again, there is nothing wrong with enjoying the blessings that God has given us. There is nothing wrong if we are prosperous. The sin comes when we don't give God the trust and the credit for it, and we don't use it to glorify his name. It's interesting, this idea of fatten your hearts in the day of slaughter. They were actually acting like pampered cattle. And it's so reminiscent of the teaching of the Old Testament prophet Amos. In Amos chapter 4, verse 1, it says, and I quote, "Hear this word, ye cows of Bashan, who are on the mountain of Samaria, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to their husbands, 'Bring wine, let us drink.'" Amos calls these wives of these men the cows of Bashan, fatten for the days of slaughter. And then James says in verse 6, "You have condemned, you have murdered the just, he does not resist you." The phrase "you have condemned" seems to refer to the financial and judicial exploitations, maybe of widows, orphans, strangers, the poor, the socially powerless, the outcast. God is a defender of the needy. God is a defender of the neglected. And as the children of God, we have a responsibility to do that whenever we see the opportunity to do it. The idea of murdered the just probably is in the sense of acts of violence and hateful attitude. Jesus told us in the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, that if you hate a brother, it's as if you had murdered him. This may not necessarily always be a physical murder, but it could be a social or a attitudinal murder. The just, some link this to Jesus because it is in the singular, but the context to me seems to relate rather to the suffering child of God, the suffering saint. Although it would be true if one wanted to apply it to Christ also. He does not resist you, it says. In this age, God's people could not and maybe should not react and retaliate, but they will testify on the judgment. The way we treat others will be a witness against us or for us in the judgment day. Christ's example of not resisting when he was being beaten and mocked and spat upon is a good example for us. There's an interesting passage that sometimes causes difficulty for people in Matthew chapter 5, verse 39, where it tells us to turn the other cheek. I do not believe that rules out self-defense, but rather it connotates the taking of insults or insulting behavior. We are not necessarily to stand by and be beaten or to stand by and be murdered or have our families treated in such a way. But whenever possible, we should take the insult rather than rebuking it back and exacerbating the situation. Filled with frustration over an unceasing fraud at the hands of rich people, a saint might begin to wonder, a Christian might begin to wonder, where is the justice of God? And James makes it clear that vengeance belongs to God. Paul said that in Romans chapter 12. And that God will exact payment for the oppressive and fraudulent treatments of others. But this is not a new consideration. The little book of Habakkuk, just three chapters, is about Habakkuk asking the Lord this very question. Let me read to you verses 2, 3, and 4 of Habakkuk chapter 1. O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out to you, violence, and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore the law is powerless and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore perverse judgment proceeds. Habakkuk was saying to the Lord, I see all of this injustice. I see all of this cheating. I see the rich defrauding the poor. How long are you going to let this continue? But one of the most wonderful verses for us to keep in mind is found in the very last part of this book of Habakkuk, in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 18, where after the Lord answers Habakkuk and says that he's got things under control, Habakkuk says, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. When we see injustice, whether it's to others or whether it's to ourselves, we have the great comfort that we can rejoice in the Lord and that He will be a just judge and that we will have joy in our Lord upon salvation. Now we turn to verses 7 through 12 of this fifth chapter. And we're told there to be patient, to persevere, to endure. Again, it's very similar to some of the opening thoughts that James had at the beginning of this book in chapter 1, where he says, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, but let patience have its perfect or complete work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Let me begin now by reading verses 7 through 12 of chapter 5. Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain, you also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. We have heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord. For the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brethren, do not swear, neither by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, lest you fall into judgment. As we consider this group of verses, James and other New Testament authors had a great faith and assurance in the Lord's returning. But as they awaited for His return, the patience was to be the clarion call for them, as it is to be for us today. And James gives us three examples of patience in these verses. Number one, the patience of the farmer in verse 7. Number two, the patience of the Old Testament prophets in verse 10. And number three, the patience of Job in verse 11. Three wonderful examples of patience and endurance for us. So let's look now at a little more detail at verse 7. Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and the latter rains. To be patient is the theme and the emphasis of this text. In James chapter 1, verse 4, he says, "But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." The word is used four times here, twice in verse 7, and once in verses 8 and 10. It's the basic meaning of long-suffering. This term is used of God's patience with mankind. And hasn't God been patient with us? Who of us would have been as patient as God has been? Now, there have been times, the flood and so forth, that God's patience seemed to have almost run out. And someday, it will run out. And when it does, the Lord will come for His righteous people, and life here on this earth will end. But it's a term used for God's patience with mankind. It is also one of the fruits of the Spirit that we find for us in Galatians chapter 5, verses 22 through 23. It really carries the idea of being long-tempered and not short-tempered. Oftentimes we get short-tempered about situations or people, but we should be more long-tempered and more patient and enduring. And it's referenced as such in 1 Corinthians 13 as one of the characteristics of love. And we finally see here in this particular phrase, the beginning phrase, pardon me, of verse 7, that he's addressing this to the brethren. He's addressing it to Christians. This is a teaching not simply for the world, although it's good for all people, but this is a teaching for those of us that are the children of God. And we are to be patient, how long? Until the coming of the Lord. Literally, that phrase there is from the Greek word parousia. Until the parousia, which means the presence. Until Jesus is present with His saints once again. Now, Jesus will not set foot on earth again, but He will come down from heaven and He will receive the righteous up into the clouds to be with Him forevermore. Now let's look at the first example of patience that James gives us, and he gives it to us here in verse 7. The farmer who waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early rain and the latter rain. This is the first of those three examples of patience. The farmer is totally dependent upon the weather, rain and sunshine. And he has no control over when it's going to rain. He has no control over when the sun is going to shine. He simply has to patiently wait for those blessings. He plows and he sows in faith and hope but he has to patiently wait. And notice the passage here says the early rains and the late rains. Well, the early rains in Palestine were probably in the October-November time frame, and they were needed for the seed to sprout. The late rains, which might come in April and May, were needed for the crops to mature. This may imply that the recipients of James were in or near Palestine, or else they knew about the Palestinian climate. But being nourished is not a one-time need, just like rain is not. And whether you're a farmer or not, we all understand that seeds need moisture in order to germinate, but farmers will tell you that their crops need moisture in order for instance, the ears of the corn to fill out and to be plentiful. So there is the need for the early rain, and there is the need for the latter rain. Verse 8 says, "Be also patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." The concept of establish your hearts means to strengthen your hearts, make them stronger. This is another imperative, to trust and wait on God's promises. It takes a strong heart sometimes to be patient. An anemic spiritual life will not see us through. And patience is a very difficult thing for most of us. It's easier for us to say, "I want to be more patient," or "I'm working on my patience." But it is very easy for us to become impatient with even rather menial tasks here on this earth. Well, the early Christians probably dealt with the difficulty of wondering whether Christ was really going to come and being patient for that. What are we doing to establish or strengthen our hearts? James tells us to establish and strengthen our hearts. What are we doing to establish our Christian life? Well, there's many things we can do, but this is certainly one area where the family of God and the church really can come to bear. Being there one for another, and we're going to see that more as we get into the latter part, I believe, of this chapter. Paul, writing to the Romans in Romans chapter 1, verse 11, says, "For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that I may establish you." Paul longed to be able to be with them, to teach them, to give them gifts so that they could be strengthened, because the coming of the Lord is near. They may have expected Jesus to come quite soon. We don't know that for sure. But regardless, Jesus is going to come quickly when compared to eternity, whether it's 2,000 years or 3,000 years or 4,000 years after his ascension from this earth. It's all quickly when it is compared with eternity. Often the New Testament authors seem to have expected the second coming to happen quickly. The imminence of the second coming is meant to encourage every generation of believers when confronted with worldly pressures. The time of his return is uncertain, but the event is not uncertain. It is sure. Believers, therefore, should live every day in the expectation of their Lord's glorious return. The major New Testament word to all believers is, be ready and be active. In our next session, we'll take up with verse 9 of this fifth chapter. But James is telling us to have our faith and our trust not in our material things. If we're blessed with them, that's fine. But if they become a distraction or they become a temptation, then nothing is worth being distracted from our service to the Lord. If you have time to look over the rest of this fifth chapter before our next video, that would be very helpful. But we enjoy very much your being with us and our chance to share with you and to go over with you these wonderful words of inspiration and encouragement that James, with the Holy Spirit, is giving to us. So may the Lord bless you and keep you and watch over you, and may you have a prosperous time until we meet again. May the Lord be with you.